Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki sit down with Dr. Edwin Ritchie, Extension Soil Specialist with the University of Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hello, Jay.
How is how's everybody doing on this hot, steamy July day?
Yeah, we roll right into, July here in the latter part of July when we're recording this. And we got the dog days of summer going on right now for sure. The temperature is pretty warm and pop-up showers happening. I had one at my house this morning, actually, and cut some hay yesterday, so I should have known that something was going to happen. So, but we had a little shower this morning, so we'll take it. Any kind of moisture this time of year, we'll take it.
Washed that hay off real good for you?
It did. It's fine. It's all good. As long as it don't get about Friday and do that, everything will be fine.
Well, you know, if you've listened to this show very much this summer, we've talked about the lack of humidity because we hadn't had any up until now. And you know, all of the what little storm fronts we've had have all come from the north or northwest, and that has somewhat created a frontal boundary that's kept that southern air down there where it belongs, as far as I'm concerned.
It was plenty humid yesterday at the UK field day in Princeton, I can tell you.
It wasn't very humid in Jay's. I was in there judging Jay's.
I thought about y'all in the air
conditioning. Fair stuff in the air conditioning. It wasn't very humid in there, Vicki.
Well, I had enough humidity for all of you.
But point is, now we have humidity. Some of these frontal boundary areas have changed, and we're getting some storms coming up from out of the south and the southwest, and more like what we're accustomed to this time of the year. So we'll just have to see. There's folks that's getting a little bit of rain. There's folks that's getting a whole lot of rain, more than they need.
Sure.
And we'll just have to see what the rest of July and August are like as far as rainfall goes. So. What's going on in McLean or Webster County these days?
Well, today's Farmers Market Day in Webster County. Our market's always open on Wednesday. Jay, you came in and folks was out there. And so, you know, it's a good time to encourage folks to support their farmers markets. So get out there and shop local and that kind of thing. We've been getting some rains. We haven't gotten any floods like some of the other areas we did in May, but after that. So, I mean, crops are starting to look better and, you know, we're just trugging along.
You know, I talked to a producer yesterday when I was cutting hay on probably the roughest field that I've got, and it's a lot of sinkholes, and I was dodging sinkholes and trying to talk to him at the same time. But he was talking about, a lot of this yellow spots in these corn that, you know, I mean, it looks like it ran out of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of what my thoughts were. And he had actually bought a drone and was thinking about possibly putting some, you know, he said, you know, I would for sure if I could find some ammonia nitrate. He said, I for sure try to put some on because the drone came with some kind of spreader or something on it. So, I think there's a lot of places in McLean County that are like that. I mean, you know, we had the rain out and had the flood and had a lot of replant corn and that kind of thing. And, you know, for probably a month now, I've been thinking, boy, that corn sure is yellow. You know, I don't know as it hadn't run out of nitrogen, you know, so maybe that's something you want to do. I don't know. It may be too late by now. I don't know. But it sure looks like it could use some nitrogen, that's for sure.
Definitely some yellow spots out there that you can see. If you can see over the top of some of these fields as you come off hillsides and things like that, you can see some out there. Hopkins County right now, where I'm seeing a lot of the same things that you all are talking about, it's fair week. So we expect really, really hot temperatures, high humidity, and lots of rain at some point every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Had our sheep and goat show last night. That's always a big hit. The youth livestock shows are probably my favorite parts of the fair. I have a hog show tonight and then a beef show tomorrow night. So everybody always looks forward to that night of the beef show. It's the longest night of the fair by far. Yeah. That's when we'll have the most participants. But when it's over, for the most part, the fair's over as far as all ag concerns are. So we're all looking forward to that.
I guarantee it.
So.
It's always good to get fair over with, that's for sure. For those of us that have a
Vicky
fair.
Vicky wouldn't know, yeah.
I know, and for those of us that have a fair.
She doesn't have one of those.
Webster County is one of the few counties in the state of Kentucky that does not have a county fair, so.
I think it'd be a good project to get one started, Jay.
Yeah,
don't you?
I mean, wouldn't you? That could be your legacy.
Yeah, whoa.
It could be. Not sure that'll happen.
Yeah. I'm going on out on a limb and say it's not going to happen. Yeah. Pretty sure that's not going to happen.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, though, because that comes up a lot from folks. Especially like judge executives and folks like that. And I understand because it brings people to your community from other communities. And it gives you the opportunity to showcase and as far as, you know, the 4-H and FFA, but we don't really have any fair. We don't have a good place to even for fairgrounds. I mean, that's been a big holdup. Is there's just not a really good place for fairgrounds. And then, you know, it's a great idea to have events and things, but there's this thing that goes along with it. You got to have a lot of people that's willing to work it.
Yep.
And that is usually where the problem falls is
in smaller communities. That's definitely the case, and it's with any type of local event, whether it's any type of local festival that you may have or anything like that. Finding enough people to work them.
All of a lot of the cities here have their own little deal, you know, like Clay Days or Aunt and Hay Days. They have their own little festivals, and none of those want to give them up either. And I understand that too, because that's their. You know, that's their town and they're proud of that. And so I don't know that there'll really ever be a county fair here. They tried to do a few things, Blue Ribbon Days a few years ago, but, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
Absolutely. Well, moving into our show, we've got a guest with us today, Mr. Edwin Ritchie. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Tell us just a little bit about yourself. It's the first time you've had a chance to be on the show with us, so tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be in your position.
How long do I have?
Not that long.
Not that long. So my dad was in the military. Our family's originally from Middle Tennessee. I moved over quite a bit when I was younger, and sixth grade came back to around the Clarksville area, stayed there till I graduated from UT Martin, and then mom and dad moved back towards the family farm around McMinnville, Tennessee. I went to Knoxville. I was at Knoxville when Peyton Manning was there and Pat Head Summit was big. And then I took a job with the tobacco breeder at Lexington, Bob Miller. And
Mr. Bob Miller, yeah.
Mr. Bob Miller, and I worked there while I worked on a PhD, and job came open in Princeton, Kentucky for soil management, and I applied and got that job and been happy in Princeton ever since.
You know, we've had a lot of specialists through the years who maybe were from Kentucky, ended up working for University of Tennessee and vice versa. Bob Miller was one of those. I think he was from Laurel County, Kentucky, if I'm not mistaken, worked at UT. Dr. Gary Palmer was from Tennessee, ended up working at UK, but both of those professors were specialists, worked in the tobacco business, and that's where we've shared so many people through the years.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So you're located at Princeton. I dare say it, the research station, that's what we've referred to it as for years, but right now it's probably just the mobile office spaces.
More or less, we have two trailer complexes set up, and my joke is, I believe you've had Chris Teutch in here a time or two. He's my next door neighbor, and we have thin walls. So whenever Chris is on a conference call, I'm on that call with him. You got to be careful what you say around there if you don't want someone to hear it.
That's right. Of course, a lot of people that may not know, we lost our research station at Princeton with the tornadoes in December of 2021, the long track tornado that did so much damage. But we're on the plans to rebuild, and hopefully we'll have something back. I won't say bigger and better, but maybe better.
We're hoping so.
When it's all said and done.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
It was good to have folks back on the station there talking about Princeton and the tornadoes, and of course, and right before that, all the renovation. And so, you know, we didn't have field days there because of COVID, and then you didn't have things after the tornado, and it was I was really glad to be back at Princeton with the corn, soybeans, and tobacco field day and having folks there, because there's so much research that goes on at that farm. It's a tremendous facility, not the brick and mortar, but just the work that happens mm-hmm. on that farm.
Yes.
Is so important for all the commodity, for all areas. And it's so much more than what you can see from the highway. And I think that we need to take every opportunity we can to make sure people know that, and to keep people coming to Princeton, even though it is two mobile units there now. But it's important to keep people coming to that farm. And so,
well, it's important to agriculture.
It is huge.
Especially here in Western Kentucky.
Absolutely.
And to be real honest, all across the state of Kentucky. But, you know, the work that they do is significant and needs to be viewed that way. And, you know, we may not have to be able to have all the different activities that we used to have there in Princeton, but the work has continued. It continued yeah. through COVID. It continued through after the tornado, after they got everything cleaned up. And, you know, it's just a shout out to those folks and Edwin and all the folks that work there at Princeton, the work that they continued to do through the obstacles that they had to endure.
So, absolutely.
You know, I think about you talking about the impact it's had on the state, and I think about some of the programs there that even have impact on agriculture beyond the state of Kentucky, particularly a lot of the dark tobacco work that's been done mm-hmm. through the years took place mm-hmm. there. The original no-till production work that was really started in West Kentucky, or I guess maybe we could say perfected in West Kentucky. Some of that work was done with Dr. Shirley Phillips way back in the day that, mm-hmm. that took place there at Princeton, and it's had far-reaching impacts on grain production really across the world.
Well, and I'll tell you, yesterday, Dr. Lloyd Murdoch was there, and of course we all know him, and of course that's your predecessor, right?
Yes.
But he was there yesterday, and I saw a picture yesterday afternoon, and it was Lloyd was sitting in there in the building there, or the equipment shed there where we ended, and there was this young man sitting there beside him, and Lloyd was talking to him, and they was having a conversation, and what they were talking about is this young man was interested in going to college and majoring in agronomy. And he was wanting to talk to, you know, Lloyd was there. And so he sat down there and talked to Lloyd about that. And they had a great conversation from what I understand. And that picture is, it's worth 1,000 words, because that's what we do in Extension. That picture says what we should be doing in Extension. Maybe I should say it that way. But it's because we help people. Whatever the subject is, we try to help folks that are needing help, and trying to educate folks and all the research that you all are doing. But, you know, that's what we do. And it was kind of nice to see that, because you had the young man getting ready to graduate high school and Dr. Murdoch that's retired, but they were sitting there having a conversation. And mm-hmm. so that was, I think that's just kind of speaks to what Extension is all about.
Yep. And Lloyd still enjoys it. He's in his 80s now, and he still shows up 2 days a week.
Yeah.
Yep. That's good.
Yeah.
Old habits die hard.
Well, you know, and the knowledge that Lloyd has over all the years, and look at all the changes that Lloyd has seen in mm-hmm. his time as being, you know, there at Princeton as doing research there on the research station. The changes that have been in agriculture are phenomenal, mm-hmm. you know, and seeing some of the things I don't think we'll ever see in our lifetime, mm-hmm. the changes that he has seen in his lifetime. So, I mean, that's a pretty good deal to have him come back around a little bit.
And when he started, I mean, Princeton was, I mean, you know, he was kind of one of those that really, I don't know if you'd say, brought awareness. I don't know the word I'm looking for, but you know, he and some of those other specialists, they didn't, when they came along, they didn't have near all the facilities and labs and that we have now, for sure.
They had to scrap for a lot of what they that's
kind of what I was meaning, you know, and just mm-hmm. and so
for a long time they had to do that. Yep. That's right.
We still kind of do.
Yeah. When the tornado came through, it seems like you've had to go back to scrapping for everything you can possibly get your hands on.
That's right.
Yeah. So.
Well, Edwin, talk to us just a little bit today. We're going to talk about a variety of subjects, but we're in late July now. We're probably at least a month out from corn harvest beginning, and I think this year, the way the crops divided up, probably a little longer than that. We may be thinking more towards Labor Day when a lot of combines get to running. But as we start thinking about fall fertility, what some of the things that our producers should be thinking of?
Well, Dave said something that kind of made me think. Seeing some yellow corn, chances are real good that that's nitrogen. But, you know, ear leaf sample right now might not be a bad thing just to confirm that. Yeah. It's getting kind of late to start spreading nitrogen. It's a lot better to put it on up front or earlier. Yeah. But if you're really, really short, you could benefit from some if you could get it flown on.
A lot of that, I guess it depends what growth stage it was
exactly,
in at the time.
Exactly. But thinking about getting ready for your fall fertilization, your fall soil sampling, going back to the corn nitrogen, maybe corn stalk nitrate test just to see how your previous nitrogen fertility scheme worked. It's kind of a afterthought, but it's a good thing. So that's another option you could.
Could some of those yellow spots, Edwin, be compaction? I mean, we had a ton of rain here in this local area. You know, could some of that possibly be compaction or something of that nature?
It could very well be.
Changes in soil type, too, maybe? I don't know if that would, thinner type soils that's...
Or more shallow soils. Yeah. Yeah. There's not enough soil to keep this water out of the root zone, and, it's hurting the corn.
You know, a lot of the ground that I'm probably seeing that on is probably a lot of Karnak type soils, and that when you get on that at the wrong time, number one, is the wrong thing to do. But I mean, you could be fighting from the word go and still have problems that you have now. I don't necessarily think this year the first planting was like that. I believe a lot of it had to do with the second planting.
Right.
Really to come in there and I think the first planting got flooded out, and then you've got corn that is tossling, and you've got corn that's knee high in the same field, and a lot of that tossling corn is intermittent throughout the whole field, so they didn't really get it destroyed like they probably should have. And then there's a lot of yellow corn, really wavy, really uneven corn that's going on. So I just wonder sometimes if that's not a little bit of compaction to multiply the problem of maybe running out of nitrogen too.
It could very well be. I mean, we've had such wet springs off and on, so there's been short planting windows, and sometimes you're trying to get on something that probably would be better off waiting a few days, but you got a lot of corn to get over, so what do?
Yeah.
Especially that replanted, because, that's when we sit in there here and got that seven, and your county too got those big rains, and then we were out for till the end of May, from May the 7th until the last
three weeks.
Yeah, it's 3 weeks, and so then just when you could get in there, it was go time, and that's, and like you said, that may be more the problem corn that we're seeing. And
some of these problems, as I've just been riding around and not knowing the individual history, I think about it being 2023, and we're only a year removed from one of the times when we had all-time nitrogen highs as far as prices goes, and availability issues with a lot of our inputs. I wonder how much fertility got shortcut going into the beginning of 2022, and are we seeing some of those problems out there now? You'd almost want to know that history to make some of those calls. So, unfortunately, we know a lot of land got done that way just because either they couldn't get the product or they were having to put it where they needed it the most because of expenses.
And then when a plant's already stressed for whatever reason, then it shows symptoms of every, other things. And if it wasn't under stress, you might not notice it as much. Nitrogen is a different one.
Right.
But
Edwin, talk a little bit about taking those leaf samples and how folks need to do that and where they can send those and some of that kind of information. Because, you know, my guess is a lot of our folks that are listening probably don't have any experience doing that. And, you know, a little bit of education would probably benefit them a little bit about that, those taking those leaf samples, what they can test for and that kind of thing.
Well, you can use it several different ways. It's a tissue sample is not really a great tool in guiding how much you're going to apply, how much fertilizer, but it does give you an indication of whether you're short or something's going on. And so, for example, if you're seeing yellow spots in a field, it's a good idea to take some samples from that yellow spot and then the good green spot. And what we're typically looking at, I mean, the ideal time is ear leaf, so somewhere around R1. Take good and bad samples and send it off to a commercial lab. Most commercial labs will run those. It's, I don't know, $10-15 a sample. Not a deal breaker. But then, you know, they'll typically offer 10 to 15 different nutrients. The one I use is 11 nutrient most of the time. The one I use most of the time, 11 nutrient panel. And that gets me almost 99.99% of the information I need when I'm trying to diagnose a problem. So it's great. Soybeans, you're looking at R1 or R3, something like that. And at the top, trifoliate. So that means the open, most open leaves that aren't touching. And send those off. And, you know, do a direct comparison, compare it to good and compare it to bad. Mm-hmm. And then if it comes back bad, we'll start digging around. Why is it? Why is my nitrogen or my potash low? Dig around. Is it the roots? We have a restrictive root system. Okay. It could be compaction,
right?
You know, or, well, we don't really, but maybe for some reason or another, this spot held water more. Or maybe it was just in a spot of the field that the buggy missed. So, I mean, kind of, I was talking, had a faculty meeting the other day, and we got to give presentations to our peers, and they're like, wow, y'all are like CSI people, aren't you? I said, well, yeah, in some ways.
A little bit, sometimes.
You got to figure out what's going on. And
yeah.
Oftentimes, especially when you're trying to diagnose a problem, it's a process of elimination a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. And then you ask the right questions and hope you get the right answers.
And then sometimes, I mean, none of us like it when this happens, but sometimes it's very difficult to get a definitive answer on some things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because if environmental type things, that the causes are likely to be something environmental, and it's, you know, and that's really frustrating. It's frustrating to the farmer because they're wanting to know exactly what happened and how do we make sure this doesn't happen again. It's frustrating to us because we want to be able to give them that answer. But sometimes there isn't a definitive cause.
So many moving parts and so many people involved with it. It just one of those things can make a big difference.
Sure. That's exactly right. Talking about sampling and that type of thing, from a soil sampling standpoint, you know, over the years, there's been a lot of different opportunities, changes on how best to soil sample. You know, used to, you just go out and soil sample, you break it into 20 acres or whatever and soil sample it that way. And then I know when I graduated college and went to work, that was the era when 2.5 acre grids. That's when everybody was soil sampling on 2.5 acre grids, and then it kind of went away from there. And then I know there's different types, but just talk about the different, those kinds of things, and then maybe suggestions on when you want to do some kind of a grid or zone sampling or you know, just over what you have seen and the people that you've worked with and recommendations and, you know, just different ways to do that.
Well, the grid sampling versus the zone sampling versus just a random sample, I like to think of them as different tools in a toolbox. One thing that maybe some people might not like to hear, and this is some fresh data that we're seeing. My counterpart in Lexington, Josh McGrath, he left about a year ago, and I took over his PhD student, and they're collecting data that suggests 2.5 acres isn't much better than a 12 or a 20 acre random sample, because there's so much variation in mm-hmm. that 2.5 acre grid.
Yep.
They're saying if you really want to know how accurate to be, you or how they're suggesting 0.5 acre grid is where you need to be. And that's awful tight. That's a lot of samples. That's a lot of money. So do you do that? I mean, I think if you can afford something like that, that give you all kinds of information and then put you in a zone sampling scheme. Mm-hmm. So now you have different zones. But that's super intensive. I mean, that's almost impossible to do.
I think sometimes you can get so much information that you get frustrated and don't know what to do with it.
Oh,
and
that's
I think,
right.
And I do think that's kind of with yield mapping and things like that, you do get so much information, sometimes you don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. But the second part of that is, and this is what we ran into when I was sampling on 2.5 acre grids, you got a lot of great information. But when we first started doing that, we didn't have a way to spread it. We didn't have a way to spread it any differently. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of variable rate lime.
Yes.
But as far as the fertility side of it, you know, there was not really a way. So we was trying to figure out, we were still working on averages.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of doing a 9-23-30 on across the board, we was doing more adjusting based on those soil test results. You know, we may be put more, you know, potash in the mix or DAP or whatever it is. But are we still in that same situation if you're sampling on a 0.5 acre? Can you really spread on a 0.5 acre? And it change every 0.5 acre if you needed to?
It's
are
hard.
We there
I mean,
now?
No, I don't think we're there realistically from a production standpoint. The one place we are, and it's getting away from soil sampling, but nitrogen application based on active sensing. Mm-hmm. So green seekers or something like that, crop mm-hmm. circle, where you're actually reading the NDVI real time. That sensor is programming, the computer's mm-hmm. calculating based on the N enriched strip, this is how much we need to put. But for P and K, it's to me, it's not there yet. And we're getting better all the time, but
right.
It's asking a lot.
Edwin, do you think that, you know, I've looked at lots of yield maps, and I'm sure you have too, and over several years, you know what your good ground is, you mm-hmm. know where your bad ground is, and don't you think you could almost overlay that and kind of make a zone
yes.
kind of deal and really, to me, that's, and I almost guarantee you that the soil types will break up the same as mm-hmm. as a lot of the ground, you know, mm-hmm. as your yields change from point to point.
Yeah, and like Vicky said, there's so much information you have. If you can figure out what to do with that information,
right.
that's a great, you know, great application of that information. You can't do it over 1 year, but,
right.
you know, multiple years, that high-yielding ground is almost always going to be high-yielding ground. And then in the wet years where it's not, well, maybe this is poorly drained, where you don't see
right.
it quite in an average year.
Yep.
Or vice versa, in the real dry years, man, this stuff is really yielding good. Why? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe a shallow water table here, and mm-hmm. when you get normal rainfall.
Or yeah. a topography change, and you're going to have water directed
uh-huh.
towards a certain part of the field mm-hmm. and away from others.
Yeah. Yep.
To me, it's almost like common sense stuff. We try to get so technical.
Mm-hmm.
And we overlook a lot of the common sense stuff of just like taking those yield maps, because those, I don't know hardly of any combine that doesn't generate yield maps today. I mean, unless you've got some older combines. But take that data and take those yield maps and kind of overlay your soils map and kind of try to figure out, you know, and you can do a better job soil sampling and kind of do some zone sampling. Just about most all of the fertilizer applicators now have, you know, that they're doing, you know, putting fertilizer on variable rate. So if you're into that and you want to do that, why, you know, that opportunity's there. But, you know, you can figure out your zones by just overlaying those yield maps and soils maps together. And to me, that's a lot of common sense stuff that people just, they try to get so technical with it, but it's really not technical. It's kind of common sense kind of stuff.
Agreed.
I was talking yesterday with some other agents, and one of the things that we were talking about is just implementing practices and doing things on farms and for IPM purposes is what we were talking about. But the farmers, if they've been farming a piece of ground very long at all, like you said, they know that ground. Mm-hmm. They know what that yield potential is going to be, you know, aside from a flood or a drought or a, you know, hailstorm or whatever. Right. They're going to get pretty close to this field should average about this amount of time. And, I mean, going back to what you said, you could take that information and build your zones around that and figure out, you know, where we need to go from there. And pH is something that we talk about it, but then a lot of times we spend a lot of time on P and K too. Mm-hmm. But talk just a little bit about the importance of getting our pH right before we start worrying about, you know, doing too much with our P and K.
Well, the pH is often called the master variable because it does influence so much stuff. It influences phosphorus availability. A lot of the critters in your soil, they're going to thrive at a more neutral pH. You get your pH too low, and then you start reducing micronutrient availability. You get your pH too high, then you start increasing your micronutrient availability to a point that you can have toxicity. So my great uncle used to have a saying, too much of a good thing isn't necessarily a good thing.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of want it like Goldilocks, just right. But pH
like
is
Mama Bear's porridge.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, pH, that's something, don't overlook it. You the money you spend in keeping your pH around 6.5 for all of our row crops is about as good a money as you can spend.
And all lime is not the same.
That is correct. The University of the state actually does the sampling. The university analyzes it, but you can look. They sample all the quarries that sell lime twice a year, and it gives you your relative neutralizing value, so more or less your effectiveness. Like urea is 46% nitrogen, ammonium nitrate is 34%. You adjust per nutrient analysis. Same thing with your lime. If it has an RNV of 100, which you won't find any in the state, you add 1 ton to get 1 ton. If your RNV is 50, then you have to add two tons of lime to get 1 ton of effective lime. Yeah. So make sure you're, you know, accounting for that. So you're applying what needs to be applied and getting down what you need to get down.
Yeah, and a lot, I know that my dad farmed, and as I've said several times on here, but, you know, his theory sometimes was, I hadn't limed that in a while. I'll probably need to put a couple ton of lime on that, you know, and that, but that's, I mean, obviously that happens still today.
Mm-hmm.
But soil tests are relatively cheap.
Yes.
And you can get
it's insurance.
Those.
It's insurance.
It is. And you can
cheap
get,
insurance.
It absolutely is. And it tells you way more than just your pH.
Yes.
And take the time and to get those samples because it does tell you a lot. And you could spend a little more money than what you were intending to, it depending on what that comes back. But it's going to help you on the long on for long term. That's going to help you. Yeah. But it could also save you money because you might be putting 2 ton of lime on that you don't need.
Mm-hmm. I think Edwin brought up a good point about the RNV values being different from quarry to quarry. Time was, years ago, we used to have people come in and ask for that report.
Yep.
It's available online now, but I don't know that. I can't remember the last time somebody actually come in and looked at that. And it's a good take-home point, I think, that a ton of lime is not a ton of lime from quarry to quarry to quarry. Mm-hmm. We have really, really good ones around this end of the state. And we have some that just lag behind those really, really good ones. I guess that's probably the best way to say it. knowing what that RNV value is, the calcium carbonate equivalency, yep, is what's going to be able to help you make informed decisions.
Agreed 100%.
I think something that Edwin mentioned, and I would love to get him on here another time because we're running a little short on time, but he talked about the good bugs in the soil and that kind of thing, and the microbes and all that kind of stuff. And there's some work being done and some folks in my county that are talking about the good bugs in chicken litter. Mm-hmm. And they're actually selling high-producing flock litter to low-producing flock houses to put the good litter in those houses to try to change the microbes in their litter to increase the efficiency of those birds and the productivity of those birds. So maybe that's a little homework for you, Edwin, but at some point we'd love to get you back on here to talk a little bit about microbes and some different things like that and soil health, because that's kind of a buzzword anymore. You know, we're talking about soil health and there's a whole group of people that are always talk about soil health, mm-hmm, you know, and kind of to dive into some of those things and maybe dispel some myths for some people and those type things. But that's a whole nother show. We'll get into that sometime, but, on here.
Every time we do this show, we think of something that we need to do another show on. I think David's exactly right. Mm-hmm. For years, and we even started this show talking about soil fertility. Mm-hmm. But soil health is the word of the day, and that's the way a lot of people are looking at this. Yeah. So managing your microbes.
Oh, well, and on that subject of chicken litter, though, in this area that we are in, mm-hmm,
it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. There's, you know, McLean County, are you all still number one in poultry?
Number two.
Yep. And we have, in Webster County, we have a good amount of poultry houses as, mm-hmm, well over here, and there's a lot of chicken litter that is sold and, mm-hmm, and spread in our areas. And
you can go through the country right now and see it piled
right
up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, it's a great nutrient source.
Well, I was going to say, you can, if you want to talk about that a little bit, but talk about that, sampling that as well.
Okay. Yeah. So like a soil sample, it's guiding you what your soil or your plants will need, what the soil might be lacking. Well, why not know what you're spreading? You know, that's, mm-hmm, especially why not know what you're buying? Because, you know, the value is based on the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium it has. So no one would ever pull up to the fertilizer, you know, store and say, hey, I need some fertilizer. What do you need? I don't care. Just give me something. Mm-hmm. I'll write you a check for, you know. So, I mean, you need to know what you're buying. And then to benefit from that, you need to be able to utilize that. Why would you put, you know, a bunch of phosphorus on a soil that's testing 300 pounds of phosphorus per acre? Mm-hmm. It's better to put that complete fertilizer, that poultry litter, somewhere where it needs it. Wow. So, I mean, it gives you a great idea of what you need, what you have, and how to match those two together. But,
you know, I can remember time was poultry litter was fairly cheap out in the country to mm-hmm, buy and have spraying. And in comparison to other nutrients. Now those nutrients have got so high in the past few years, they have kind of drug poultry litter prices along with them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the part of the world where I worked for so long, we used to see a lot of poultry litter on pastures because it was an affordable option. And those were the grounds that a lot of times needed a complete mm-hmm, fertilizer. We don't see as much of that now, but it's because of the change in the price of the product mostly. Mm. Chemical fertilizers have drug them along with them because they've become more a better looking alternative, especially in years like we've had the last 2 years.
Yeah, when the poultry houses first came, I mean, a lot of people was just, they'd almost give it away to get rid of
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they farmed as well, I mean, if they were a grain farmer as well, they was spreading it on their own farms until they realize I can't do this forever, you know, because you get those soil test levels too high and, you know, having to change up the plan.
And you can tell where these people were in a back in the day where it was more of a disposal mechanism.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The soil test closest to the barn would be through the roof.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, now hopefully that's not the case because they realize I've got a valuable resource.
Right.
Now a lot of it might be sold right out of the barn now.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Absolutely. What's the best way for of course, we've got lots of poultry producers in our area. What's the best way to take a sample, to get a representative sample of that poultry litter to get it sent off? What's the best way to do that, Edwin?
Well, it's like
I don't know if I've ever heard anybody explain it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, different ways you can do it. You know, when they're in the house, they'll come in with a little skid steer or something and move it around, push it up. If it's outside stored, you want to definitely get through the crust and sample it at several different places. So you know, the feed lines and the water lines are going to be different than the edge of the house versus the middle. So you want to try to get that as best represented as possible. I mean, I prefer to do it before I, buy it or spread it,
Sure. But
worst case scenario, you get it as they're spreading it or as they're loading it into that spreader, and then you can say, well, I applied 100 pounds of P205. I probably, it looks like I needed to put 80. Yeah. I'm where I need to be.
Yeah.
I don't need to put another ton.
Right.
So,
right.
But,
I just had never heard
sample.
I just never really had anybody, really explain that. And
you mentioned the crust, and that's something, if it's stored outside, that a lot of folks do need to know about. That top 2 to 3 inches will seal over after it's set out for a while and actually help it shed water pretty good.
The higher and tighter you can get it, the more skinny and high, the better off you're going to be. It's all about surface area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's differences between broiler litter and pullet litter and then the layer house litter. There's all differences. So if you're thinking about applying, poultry litter, be sure to know what you're getting, number one. And the best way to do that is to test it.
And is there a complete clean out litter? I mean, is that different too? When do they do that between every flock, or is it once a year? I was thinking, or something like that.
It's usually once a year. Yeah,
maybe every 2 or 3 years if we're composting in
Depending.
The house.
So that would be different too.
So you if you're buying litter, you want to know what you're getting.
What's the bedding material that goes in most of these houses nowadays? I know it varies from area to area depending on what
hulls,
they can get.
But some rice hulls and some wood chips too, I think.
My experience, if you get west of 65, it's going to mostly be rice hulls.
Mm-hmm.
But you go east of 65 and you're hauling a lot of air from Arkansas. So they're going to use wood chips a lot.
I can remember a time 20, 25 years ago when corn prices were really high, therefore rice hulls got pretty high and people used them in beef rations. And that was some of the first wood chips that I know of that went into houses, but it was because of the price and availability of rice hulls.
Right. I think they do try to get them to run them through a kiln and get them dried down really good and all that kind of stuff. The wood chips are shavings or whatever you want to call them. But it's a different deal. So that's a different material that you'd be spreading out on your field. So that's another good reason to test.
That's why I brought it up.
The
wood chips will break down just a little bit slower than what the rice hulls would.
Yep. A little different deal.
Well, that brings us to the point of the show. We always like to wrap things up with a timely tip. And since our topic today was fall fertility, we thought that would be a good time to remind producers to make plans now for soil testing this fall. We're at that time of the year. It's not going to be too awful long before, like I say, we see these combines up and going. We'll see some corn start to be harvested, and just as quick as you can behind that, I think is a really, really good time for you to get some of that fall fertility, your soil testing especially, started, especially if you're planning on a wheat crop going on behind that corn.
Agreed.
Anything you want to add to that?
I think that's real good advice. The one thing I might throw in, if you can sample in the fall, that's a great time to do it. But if you are more into spring sampling, it's probably best to stay in that spring sampling so you can compare your samples over years.
Right.
A spring sample is going to differ a little bit from a fall sample. So look at the trends.
One of the things I always liked about a fall sample, if you have a pH correction that's needed, you're giving yourself time for that lime activation to take place before it's going to be put into service again the next spring.
And generally, you're going going to be able to support that lime truck better than
that's right.
I was going to say, and you have a little bit bigger window there to get spreading done and corrections made in this. In the spring, you're fighting weather and you're fighting wanting to get in that field to get it planted.
And it gives time for that to break down and change pH and all that before you plant a new crop. So, I 100% agree with that.
Sounds good. Well, Edwin, we told you to go by quick. We appreciate you being here, and we want to thank you for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.